Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, going right into the show tonight. It is January 13th, 2011, Thursday evening, and I apologize for last week. I was pretty ill, and my voice sounded somewhat like a frog, so I can deal with the illness, but I don't think you would have dealt quite that well with my voice, and I don't think I would have made it all the way through the show. So the first show of the year, January 6th, I missed due to, I was trying to be very careful about staying away from sources of where I would get sick or whatever, but be that as it may, it got me. I still have a bit of that this week, but I think I'm finally getting over it. I still have the nose thing going on here, and I'm sure a lot of people out there are doing the same. The worldwide weather situation, I'll be talking about that. I'll be just making a little bit of commentary, just a small amount. I'm sure many people are almost tired of hearing about the issues in Arizona, but I'm sure there are people that are already covering the issue that, but the thing I've always said all along regarding shootings, whether it was the high school shootings that started in Colorado, or, you know, all of the various shootings, when you look at the people that are doing this, clearly these people are programmed, and they have that crazed, I've been programmed by the government look in their eyes. And of course, nobody, in the official sense, nobody really investigates this. Wouldn't you, as a crime scene analyst, wouldn't you say there's a pattern here? I mean, if there's a pattern to any type of murders or anything like that, serial killings, one of the first things that a investigative team tries to put together is a pattern. And there's clearly a pattern. A crazy guy walks into a room and starts shooting it up. A lot of innocent people are dead, and many times very specific people. So where do these people come from? Well, I've said this before. I've talked about this numerous times on this show, that the government has these people sitting in the pockets all over the place, and they're ready to come out on a moment's notice. They've been programmed by someone who knows how to do this. You and I don't know how to do this. Take a person and program them to, on a moment's notice and on a certain command, go out and go on a killing rampage. And of course, no one will ever be able to interview these people, because they're under lock and key by the same people, the same collage of people, let's put it that way, not the same specific people, but the same organization, where one side helps the other side in managing these situations, so to speak, after they occur. And then, of course, all the news media hits. And then my question, you see some of the main talk shows, daily talk shows, covering this endlessly. My question is, it's always been, if there is a lot in the news, a lot of coverage of something, I don't care if it's Michael Jackson or his sister or this guy in Arizona, the end question is the same. What's going on in the background when all of this is being used for smokescreen in the so-called real news, in the daily news? So you can bet there is a lot going on in the background with the smokescreen going on. But not along these same lines, but my own personal experience over the last number of weeks is I've been in a situation where I wanted to go out and just get a little more camping gear just for fun. And, you know, the old cook kits, these were the basically World War I style cook kits, where you have a little arm and a pan and a plate, and they hook together, and in the middle there's a little a pot for cooking a can of stew, and then there's a cup in the middle. And then there is usually enough room in there to put some silverware too, a little extra room. And if it didn't quite fit right, you could bend it and still fit it in there. But, you know, I've used those since I was a kid. Well, I went out and bought some. When I got these packages home of this cook kit hardware, it's the cheapest little, I mean, it looks like aluminum foil somebody took and bent into a form. And I doubt if it would stand up to a medium or small fire that you would cook on. It's just that the point is, and I don't care if it's the cell phone company's inability to provide services or answer their phones, or any major company, it seems like no matter who you call today, and I've had a few experiences even calling government offices in the last number of weeks and months, and you, of course, you get the statutory initial entry if you speak Spanish or not. And of course, if you push either button, you usually get somebody that's speaking Spanish anyway. But the point is, then you follow if you get somebody at all. But the point is that typically, now the other morning, I had a cell phone company and a major U.S. bank online for over an hour. I had two phones, one in each ear. And at the end of both of those call wait times, when I got to someone, the first thing they said was, "Oh, okay, I'm sure we can help you with that. I'll transfer you." This is so absurd, what's going on today. And then I got transferred. This is on both calls. I got transferred to someone, and a message came on and said, "I'm sorry, but we don't appear to be able to help you with your problem," and then hung up. And this was all automated. No one ever answered the phone. And this is what's going on today. It's very clear that a lot of major companies are putting all of their workforce into collection. So if you were to call in and say, "I'm going to pay something," you would probably get routed to someone very quickly, or many times an automated system where they just want to collect money from you. But that's about it. At any rate, it's very clear that the good old United States is really on its last leg. Major corporations are folding. They're just unable to cope with the situation at hand and unable to cope with maintaining the infrastructure that they developed. And one of the saddest things to see in this great country is the collapse of the infrastructure of communications, where the companies are competing against each other. When AT&T, the old Ma Bell, etc., was deregulated and split up, the assumption was that corporations would follow with a situation that was mandatory, and that is that they had to be interconnectable. But now you find that you can be in an area where there might be AT&T, but the other companies don't have any kind of agreement, so you can't use your equipment. Whereas once we had a country, it was all, in fact, the equipment that you get today, these phone companies are trying to compete, they're trying to put phones out so fast, most of them don't work. They don't do what they say they were supposed to do, but they want to get them out there so they can sell and compete. And so the end result is that the consumer just has garbage. I was working with some shelves today. You buy a kit and you put it together and it's supposed to be shelving. Before it was even together, it was falling apart. The little plastic pieces that hold the shelf up were breaking. They were too small. I mean, how much does it cost to make a little plastic part to hold a shelf up? This is the problem that, you know, the problem is that there is no control, there's no quality control. Everybody wants you to buy something, and once you do, there's no support for it, there's no quality. So at any rate, I'm not going to belabor that. But the point is, what do you do in a world like this? Well, first of all, I would not build a new house. I would not build many different things. As far as a car, I would look for a used car. It's just a situation where The manufacturing in the world has lost quality control. The resources of the world have been used up in a breakneck pace. Anyway, I'm not going to dwell on that. The only point is that in the world today, you have to pretty much do with what you have and become prepared to take care of yourselves. Okay, the one comment I have, and this I mention now and then, especially for the youth and parents that have kids, is to make sure they have plenty of free time that they can use to, not to play video games, so we're not talking video games here, where they can sit and sit in a quiet room and think. Mathematics is a good vehicle for that. But today, everything is in short sound bites, and people in general are losing the ability to think in this country where they were just bombarded by input from sound, from media, from television, from everything. In fact, the schools are set up so that they really don't allow kids time to think or develop thoughts of their own. And the parents need this too. Adults need this. Adults need time to get away and just reflect. But they're so busy running up and down the road, getting to work, and doing all the other things required of modern life that they forget about one simple thing, and that is just to live. I have an expression I developed, and I say it tongue-in-cheek sometimes when people are talking or they're talking about what's going on. I say that, you know, with me, just living seems to take up all of my time. And it's a kind of a oxymoron, but it's true. The just living, just surviving, takes all of our time. And it's ridiculous because the renaissance that should be occurring now, the tremendous renaissance in thought, in development, and progress, especially amongst the youth, is simply not happening. So at any rate, that's something that you have to painstakingly do. And the other thing is that we're just caught in this schedule of work or going to school with no relief in sight. And the problem is, let me give you an example of a typical day the way it should be. You should wake up rested. You should not wake up to an alarm clock. You should wake up because you're done sleeping. What a concept. And the next thing you should do is you should stretch, and you should probably get something to drink, and then do some exercises, some stretching, some very simple exercises just to get everything moving, and then proceed with a breakfast where you sit down and talk to people. You talk about the day that you're going to have. Another thing that people should do on a regular basis is care for their bodies and not just jump in the shower and jump out. Everything is kind of mechanized in that respect, but something that people should do on a regular basis is get a massage. And that sounds like, to some people, oh, that's a luxury item. It's really not, and I'm not promoting the massage industry or anything, but between, say, couples should give each other massages, and it's very easy to learn how to do that. But, I mean, the idea is that you have to move the blood around your body, and that's what a lot of times the massage really accomplishes, whereas if you just get dressed, go out, get in the car, drive to work, sit at work, drink some coffee, eat a McDonald's breakfast meal, your body is, you're just ignoring your body, and it's you're not developing on a daily basis the kind of things you need. If it always amazed me, if you would look in the northern climates and you go to a place, especially with elderly people, assisted living places, many of these people have a hard time even walking. There's no reason why a person of 60 to 70 to 80 years old, why they should have problems walking. It's because mainly they've sat in a chair or they have not kept that body active, especially as you progress. You have to keep that body moving. And what do? Up to age 65, that's the age you're supposed to continue to work. For most people today, work does not mean activity. It means sitting. And if you sit up until age 65, you're not going to be moving much for the rest of the years that you have left. So at any rate, let's go back to your typical day. So you get up, you have a breakfast, typically, hopefully, a fruit, vegetables, some protein, and then you would continue with a walk or something like that, and then get down to some mental work where you're exercising your brain. Your brain works best early in the morning. It's the clearest. As you go through the day, all kinds of little things happen that cause your brain to be diverted and clogged up with misinformation. Not misinformation, but just information that prevents your mind from working clearly. So a lot of your deep mental work, if you're doing, say, mathematics or science or studying, should be done even before you eat. Get up at 5 in the morning, sit down, and that's when your brain is going to be the clearest. If you have memory work, if you have a test in school, that's when your brain is going to be the clearest. And then as your day progresses, say you have a test at 4:30 in the afternoon. I always used to tell my students to do this before they take a test. Add and subtract numbers. Like 12 plus 13 is 25, 25 plus 12 is 37, 37 minus 14 is, and et cetera. You go like that. And just that random adding and subtracting of numbers clears, and you can multiply numbers, you can spell words, you can do anything, but what it does is it starts to focus your brain and allow it to work. Clears out all of the other stuff, and then I tell them after doing that for a couple of minutes, you're better off spending the first couple of minutes of your test doing that than actually working on the test, because your brain is going to work much better. So at any rate, then during the day you should have exercise activities, and people should be working on things that actually advance their life. Unfortunately, most of us, including myself, I'm as guilty of this as anybody, of being caught up in all of these things that we have to do to maintain a normal life. And it gets fairly complicated. If you have a normal life today with normal levels of activity, things get very complicated, trying to manage household issues, etc. So the trick is trying to streamline all of that so that you are keeping your brain free to work, and then plan your future. Work on today. Today should be your future. You should be in a situation where life is good, so to speak, that life is treating you well. You have a balance between work and play, and socializing. Socializing with the people that count in your life. So anyway, that's enough of that, but back to the idea that you need free time in your life, and this 40-hour a week job that most people are strapped to does not accommodate that. It doesn't allow you to have free time, and so the end result is millions and hundreds of millions of people with the lives that are basically controlled. They have no ability to have a satisfying life. So people, like especially in the United States, I find are very unhappy. They're very they have like a checklist. I get this a kick out of this thing. There was a movie, I forget what it is, the list that you're supposed to have. A bucket list of all the things that you're supposed to do before you die. Well, then that is more like a program thing where, okay, now we're going to go do this. Now we're going to go ride bicycles. Okay, now we can check that off of our list because we rode bicycles. Now I'm going to go visit some country And it's, we have to plan a year in advance because we only get 1 week off from work. And so then we go visit that country. Well, now we can check that off our list because we visited that country. That's a horrible, horrible examination of our society, where you have to have a list of things that you're going to do before you die, and you check them off the list. When I used to go to countries when I was younger, I used to go there and just move there. And you would live there, and on the weekends you would go and do different things. You cannot visit a country in a week or 2 weeks or even 4 weeks. You need a lot of time if you're going to assimilate the culture. You need to speak the language. You have to confront the people. You have to talk to them in small towns and big cities. You have to actually go to those places and be there without the idea that on a certain date I got to leave. It has to be open-ended. So put that on your bucket list. And for each one of your items on your bucket list, if you can't do that, then all you have is a list of things you're going to do. You're going to do them in a couple days or in a week. You're going to check them off, and then you're going to die. And so it's not a what I would call a good plan, but it's very telling of society that we need a list to tell us what we should do before we die. That's it's a image of a sick society, not a healthy society. Excuse me, a little bit of that cold left there. So I'm going to shift into talking about the weather now. And as I did this, as I was getting ready for the show tonight, I flipped up CNN, and of course I call that the Candy Nugget News. Because talk about the controlled news, the epitome of controlled news, where you get the sugar-coated stories, and in the way they want the public to see them. So, okay, here we have unbelievable world weather. This past week in January, the first week of January, there was snow in every state in the United States. Every state. Except Florida, where there was freezing rain. So I don't know if you would call that good, that they only had freezing rain and not snow. But literally, now let's include all of the 49 states, including Hawaii. It snowed in Hawaii, of course, in the mountain and the elevations. But, of course, Alaska and the other 48 states. But we're talking California. We're talking Texas, Arizona, New Mexico. Every state, all through the South, it snowed in Louisiana. It snowed in every state in the country, in the United States, except for Florida, where they had freezing rain. Now, I went to the CNN article. And, of course, the title of the article said, World Weather Woes Explained. Now, they have some meteorologists on there, and they were going to tell you why exactly the world weather is so strange. And, of course, the first thing they say is La Niña, the close relative of El Niño. El Niño is a heating of the surface water of the Pacific Ocean. The La Niña is a cooling of the surface water of the Pacific Ocean. And then they listed another factor, the North Atlantic Oscillation. And this is an oscillation in surface temperature over the Atlantic Ocean. And so these, they say, one causes the other. But there's never any real hard data. What does a cooling of water, surface water in the Pacific, have to do with the snowstorms on the northeast coast of the United States or in Europe? So I did a show, I think my last show at the end of last year, I talked about this, and I said that it's like a refrigerator store and a car dealer store next to each other. The price of refrigerators goes up and the price of cars goes up. So you have a car dealership next to a refrigerator sales location. And so if the price of the refrigerators go up and the price of cars go up. In the science world, they would say, oh, the price of refrigerators is driving up the price of cars, which is absurd. It has nothing to do with it. They're simultaneous phenomenon. We can see that the price of refrigerators is going up and the price of cars is going up, but something larger is causing the rise in price on both of them. So at any rate, the point is that when meteorologists get involved, the real causes of weather are never brought to the surface. The fact that the sun's output is diminishing, that the visible part of the solar spectrum, the part that heats the planet, is diminishing. It's been measurably diminishing. So why is it so difficult for people to say that? Because the real reason is because they want people to be complacent, to think that this is El Nino, La Nina, or the North Atlantic Oscillation, that somehow magically this is happening. Well, all of these are sources of energy, of their sources or sinks of energy, and that's what we have in meteorology. You have sources of energy and you have sinks, in other words, locations where the energy is deposited. The North Atlantic Oscillation right now is dropping down. So they're saying that happens to be the cause of weather activity in the United States. At any rate, it's all bogus, meteorology and the climatology that goes along with it. So what is really happening? The best explanation is that, yes, the sun's energy output is diminishing. Very simple. And therefore, we are heading into a cooling period. How long will it last? The Maunder minimum in the Middle Ages lasted for about 45 years. There was a good deal of starvation, and something like that could literally wipe out the population of the world. I remember seeing a special on the Maunder minimum where the British Army took the British Navy took temperatures all over the world with its Navy, and so they were able to record the temperatures, and in fact it was a worldwide cooling. I see places where people are saying, well, Greenland is warmer, so that's where all the warmth is. No, that's not exactly true, because the warm climate should still be warm. It's very clear that there's something major going on with Earth's weather. The big storm that just went through the northeast part of the United States, interestingly enough, I was talking with someone this past week. It's very clear that a lot of the chemicals that are in the air that come from the Gulf of Mexico now, from the oil spill, and from the gases that are coming up out of the Gulf of Mexico due to the BP oil spill, a lot of those gases, a lot of gas would be mixed into the rain that eventually made its way up into northeastern United States by way of snowfall. So the situation in, it's hard to say how that could possibly affect plants or the agricultural season, but in the analysis of this, only time will tell. Remember the spots and the death of plants around the south this past summer when the gases from the Gulf of Mexico got into the rain and then sat in the rain spots, and it actually burned holes through the plant leaves. And this was widespread throughout the south. So then that acid will fall, or chemical will fall into the ground and cause the ground to become acidic, where a lot of plants would not be able to grow, plants that easily grew there in the past. The situation, I got a kick out of this too, is that Brazil was having unusual weather, and this was also supposedly caused by La Nina, the cooling of the surface water of the Pacific Ocean. the situation there is that the weather systems over the Pacific move westerly. So with those weather systems moving westerly, you would have to then believe that, according to standard meteorology, you would have to believe that the weather systems move all the way around the globe and then cause the weather pattern seen in Brazil. But once again, there's no cause and effect there. So right now, just basically a summary dealing with the world weather situation, it seems to be fairly clear that the world in general is heading through a cooling period, and will this end? It's difficult to say, but for all practical purposes, it seems that we are heading into a cooling period, and this may last. If it lasts through the summer, then there may be crop failures around the world, and by that time, it's going to be way too late for people to catch up, to start becoming prepared to take care of themselves. At any rate, okay, I'm going to switch gears again now and talk. I'm going to take basically a little bit of a walk through the galaxy. And I'm making some notes here on my notepad. Okay, back to a walk through the galaxy. And I think it's important for people to understand. I did want to make one quick comment. In reading the CNN article, I looked at the user or the reader's comments down at the bottom. And one of the user comments regarding the La Nina supposedly causing temperature, all of the foul weather, etc., around the world, and the North Atlantic Oscillation. And then someone asks in one of the user comments, does this mean that Earth is reversing its axis? And, you know, this type of thing just drives me crazy, because what does the La Nina, or a cooling of the Pacific Ocean surface water, what does that have to do with the axis of Earth? That the axis of Earth is mechanical. Or if you look at the magnetic field of Earth, there's... It's locked in. It's in the North Pole, so to speak, is in the somewhat the same direction as the celestial or axis North Pole. But there's no reason to believe that all of a sudden Earth's axis is going to flip and change. But that kind of bad information or bad scientific analysis, it's just really common of the U.S. public, and it's really an unfortunate thing that someone would be so far off in left field that they would think that the change in temperature of the surface temperatures would cause the Earth to flip its axis. Well, I mean, where's the relationship? The Earth is a big object. It's like a top, a spinning top, and to change that would require a tremendous amount of energy, and also the ability to manipulate Earth, its spin axis, etc. So, at any rate, hopefully people that listen to this show are slowly becoming educated as to the workings of the cosmos, and would not ask a question like, if the temperature is changing or if the climate is changing, would this cause the Earth to change its axis of rotation. So at any rate, science can be complicated, but it's also very easy. And the part of the problem here is the lack of education, true education of science in this country, that people simply don't understand the issues with, say, a big physical object like Earth rotating and then all of a sudden flipping its axis. What is involved here? What's really involved? And you would then understand that is too immense, enormous an issue to deal with by a simple changing of the temperature. but at any rate, the surface temperature of the Earth. Okay, so anyway, on to a walk through the galaxy. Now, one of my first papers to be published in astrophysics journals was dealt with continuing galactic formation, or the formation of galaxies. And it showed that the galaxies were forming from clouds of dust and gases that would fall in towards the galactic nucleus, and then as the material fell in closer and closer to the nucleus, it would start to spin, just like a skater. When you pull your arms in, say you're a skater, and you have your arms extended out and you're spinning, if you pull your arms in, you will spin much faster. And so that's what skaters do, and then when they want to slow down, they put their arms out. So at any rate, that's the same situation with matter that would be orbiting the galactic nucleus. And so as the clouds of dust and gases collapse around this nucleus, they're going to start to spin. And the closer the material gets to the center of the galaxy, the faster it's going to spin, ultimately spinning out of the center in a couple of columns and forming the galactic arms. But the somewhat of a rather complicated topic, but it's, if you can think of a sprinkler system, some of these old-fashioned sprinkler systems with the two arms and the water is spinning out of the watering system onto the lawn. It's a lawn watering system. And the spinning head of the watering system just spins around, and water comes out, so to speak, shooting out, and waters the lawn. The galactic formation is very similar, except that you, instead of having water coming through a tube, you have the material falling in from afar, and as it gets closer to the nucleus of the galaxy, it compresses and forms somewhat, you might call it, a liquid or a fluid flow. So this becomes a fluid flow problem in physics, where the fluid is now moving around the galactic nucleus in a belt, somewhat of a thin belt, and as more material comes in and builds up pressure, something has to give. So the out of both sides of the, out of opposite sides of the galactic nucleus, some of the molten material comes shooting out, and that's what forms stars. And then that spray goes far out away from the nucleus of the galaxy and eventually becomes stars, twin stars primarily, and some triple stars, but not many higher order stars. So the point is that the stars are formed near the galactic nucleus and then tossed out on a orbit, which eventually brings them back to the nucleus. At any rate, now you have, if you look back, then if you step back from the galaxy, you have clouds of dust and matter, gases, falling in towards the galactic nucleus. They liquefy, they become under, they come under pressure, they liquefy and then shoot out in two opposite arms. Now, as the material shoots out from the base of the galaxy, out the two arms, then the stars start to form the basic rudimentary star structures, and these will start orbiting each other. Typically in twin star systems, like Earth and Jupiter form the twin star system of what we call the Sun. Now, as these spray out, they will continue in an orbit for an extremely long period of time, and that's where the developing planets, etc., are captured. So, for example, with the case of Earth and its solar system, the material came out of the galactic nucleus, formed a star, and then later at some point, Jupiter began orbiting, and so now we have a twin star system, and that has the capability of capturing other objects. So Jupiter then had the ability to capture Saturn and Neptune, Mars, Earth, And of course, this is all a very long time ago, potentially billions of years ago in the formative stages of the solar system that we live in. And so basically the stars in the galactic arm, now there's another factor here, and that is that these objects in the galactic arm interact with the solar wind or proton wind in the galactic arm and form comet-like structures around the stars. So this is all going on as they're orbiting each other, and this is continuing on to this day. There are electric paths that traverse the galactic arm, and the stars are moving through this. When I used to teach astronomy, I used to give students an example, and just to give them a feel for how empty space is. If you took a golf ball in Minneapolis, let's say, and you took another golf ball and put it in Chicago, that would be the relative size of stars and the distance between them in our neck of the galaxy, of the Milky Way galaxy. So once again, just the distance, just to get an idea of how empty space is out where we are in the far reaches of the Milky Way galaxy. This is a relative example. If you took a golf ball in Minneapolis, and I think the distance is probably about 600 miles. If you took a golf ball in Minneapolis and a golf ball in Chicago, and just looked at their relative dimensions and the distance between them, that would be the relative dimensions of a star system in the Milky Way galaxy. Now, as you go in closer to the center of the galaxy, the stars get closer and closer together. So they are closer groupings. They're probably in. By the way, the nearest star is a number of light years away. I believe it's about 4.5 light years distance. That's a light year is the distance that light travels within 1 year. So that is pretty far away, 4.5 light years. So basically space is almost vacuous and empty out there. I just want to comment also, now and then you hear people talking about galaxies colliding and one galaxy pretty much passing through the other one or colliding. And that word collide somewhat gives you the impression that another galaxy is smashing into ours. And that's really, really not the case, because of all of this empty space, when one galaxy collides, so to speak, with another one, the stars are so far apart that there is very little activity in terms of collisions, direct collisions. So at any rate, the next point is that as the stars, or the stars, they call Jupiter a star also at this point, as the stars move out in the galaxy, they are surrounded by a cometary coma, and they are part of an electrical path that extends from the galactic nucleus out to the far reaches of the solar system. So basically, all the stars in the galaxy act like a comet, because the same exact situation is occurring when any type of object, planet, nucleus of a comet, or any type of material is in the solar system with the sun at its center. Then there is an electric charge that develops around the object. This is all explained in my book, Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes. But the point is that the stars then act as comets, bringing in materials which would probably fuel them for a long period of time. There's one major problem in astrophysics. It's one of the great unspoken problems. I was at a conference one time, and a man came up to me. He wanted to talk, and At first, he did not look like a scientist from that, at least from the meeting. But he said, asked me if I would look at something, and I said, sure. He said, okay, if you take the solar wind that's leaving the sun, and if you take the energy that's leaving the sun and form of light, and this supposedly all came from fusion deep in the core, fusion, heat turned into light, and that's what the fusion in the sun is converting matter into energy, and that's the visible and other forms of light that come out of the sun. So at any rate, he made this calculation. He said, look at this. If you convert the entire mass of the sun to visible light and other forms of light at the same rate it's burning now, then there's not enough fuel there to last very long. Also, the solar wind, there's a wind of protons that leaves the sun continually. That would also contribute to a mass loss of the sun, but he said that the sun in its, with the current standard theories, could not possibly be 4.5 billion years old. It has to be much, much younger. So at any rate, that was kind of an eye opener. And in fact, he was right he's pointed this out to many astrophysicists, and they don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole, because that means that the fusion model for the sun, with the fusion in the core of the sun, it means that that model is incorrect. And it would also imply that my model for fusion at the surface of the sun is correct, and that there has to be a replenishing agent for fuel in the sun. And so that's where the conditions of the sun out in the galactic in the galaxy, apparently a lot of material is being brought into the sun for consumption as far as burning and creating light. So with these type of factors, that would tell you that the sun can be variable in its heat output. It depends on other factors, not just something that's self-contained down deep in its core. It was that started long ago, and it has not changed since. That's the standard story for the fusion in the sun. It's deep in the core. It's going to continue for a certain amount of time, and then after that, our sun will collapse and become something else, but of course in billions of years, as according to the standard story. But the reality is that if you do the calculations based on standard physics, then the sun simply does not have enough mass to provide it with energy at the same rate it's outputting right now. It does not have enough energy to last very long, and certainly not 4.5 billion years. So that means that our sun is much younger than what scientists have claimed. And of course, the age of the sun is somewhat linked to rocks that were on the moon and found on Earth, and it seems that the oldest rocks are dated at least to 4.5 billion years, and therefore they say, oh, the sun must be that old too, and they all formed at one time. Well, there's nothing measured, there's no real science here, there's no science that would indicate that logical leap of logic, so to speak. So at any rate, back through a walk through the galaxy. So we are moving as planet Earth, actually on a path right now, it's not a path that's perfectly circular around the nucleus of the galaxy. We're moving on an elliptical path. So at any rate, and all of the other stars are following us, or some of our are already ahead of us. And these stars will, some of them, burn out during the Earth's lifetime. Some of the other stars will burn out and then simply fall back to the galactic nucleus far into the distant future. And so there are the sun and the galaxy. These are regenerative processes, apparently. we don't have enough data to understand whether these we don't have enough data to understand the full lifetime of stars and the implications. But there have been measurements made that scientists previously believed that stars should move around the center of the galaxy, that the stars should move in circular orbits around the center of the galaxy. Well, that's all fine and good, but when you do the measurements, it shows the stars moving in very odd patterns. They're not moving in circular orbits around the galaxy. They're moving in very different orbits, very elliptical orbits. And so this does not match with the concept that the standard concept that the galaxy is just a big spinning wheel and the arms are attached to it and they spin around like a great big wheel also. It simply does not make sense. We would not see all of the organized galaxies that we see out in outer space today because some would be in various states of progression. In other words, they would be they would have straight arms, they would have arms that are much more curved, and you simply don't see them. You don't see the number of examples of galactic structures that follow that. In fact, one of the biggest reasons for understanding how galaxies really form from the center out, that is, the one of the things that is really prominent in galaxies is the symmetry. That one side of the galaxy is exactly the same as the other side of the galaxy. How do those sides of the galaxy know to be exactly the same? The star density, sometimes there are gaps or holes in the arms, sometimes they're warped and twisted in the vertical direction. And how does one arm of the galaxy know to be exactly the same in those respects as the other side of the galaxy? What form of communication is going on that would allow them to be the same? And of course the answer is that the arms were formed near the center of the galaxy, and that's the end of the story. They both had the same density of material. If there was a dearth of, or a shortage of material that went into the galactic nucleus at a given time, then as the arms sprayed out from the nucleus, they would contain fewer stars because there's less material to make the stars, from which to make the stars. So at any rate, the point is that the galaxy is both gravitational and it has an electrical component, which is very important. And that's where you would lead up finally to the planets and the Sun themselves, especially the Sun and Jupiter, which were the first two members of our solar system. And then all of the rest of the members captured at some later date. Let me just quick review capture and the process involved there. Two celestial objects orbiting each other have certain gravitational properties. If an object comes in and swings in just right, it can lose energy to Jupiter and also to the Sun and drop into a lower orbit, therefore becoming captured into the solar system. Then these objects build up, for example, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune, the four outer big planets, as they're called, planets. They're really not planets, they're more like gas giants, would be a better term. But all of them have captured families of comets and asteroids, etc. And so they all have the ability, because they're part of a twin star system, that's the requirement in the study of gravity or celestial mechanics. They all are part of a two-body system, and that allows them to capture objects. It also allows them to fling objects out of the solar system at high velocity. In fact, NASA uses that technique all the time to send spacecraft to the far reaches of the solar system. it uses a reverse of that same process, where it will take a spacecraft, they'll fly it by a planet, it will gain energy instead of losing energy, and then it can go out to, if properly directed, go out to one of the other members of the solar system for a visit, for taking photos, etc. But that's how it's done. And then, once again, back to the original concept, capture is simply a gravitational, is well known, is well understood, and is very much a part of the system of development of the development of the solar system. So, if you see that all of the other stars are doing this, if all of the other stars in the galaxy are doing this, then they're all going to have Planet X type scenarios where objects are coming into the solar system or stellar system, becoming captured, and therefore all of the systems of the star systems in the galaxy have the potential to develop moons. They have the potential to develop a magnetic field, and with that a bit of life sustaining gases and water that come in also from passages of large comets by a celestial object like Earth. And all of a sudden you have all of the ingredients necessary for life and the development of life. Now, this is one of the concepts that I try and promote in the new book, The Diamond Principle, is that nature has set up a plan, and it's a very specific plan for development of the solar system, that comets coming through the solar systems can do a lot of damage, but that damage is very necessary to change the evolutionary patterns that are going on. Without those damaging encounters, we probably wouldn't even be here today. We would not be the human race, the developed race that we see today. Those violent changes are necessary. It's just like with a forest fire. To renew a forest fire is actually a good thing because it burns down the brush and the underbrush and allows the new growth in the area to prosper. So at any rate, we'll be back next week with another, and hope to be here every week this year. This is James McKinney. Now, remember to visit my webpage, JM as in Mary, CC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo, JMCCSCI.com. And about a time here tonight. We'll see you next week. This is Jim McKinney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.